Lord Vader, Operation Andor is underway.
Excellent. If we release 3 episodes per week, the Lorehounds will never be able to cover every episode. The Imperial forces will crush the rebellion before it begins.
Stand by. We're picking up something on our scanners.
Echo Squadron, reporting in.
Delta Squadron, on your left.
Django Squadron, on your 6.
With Imperial forces coming in fast, we're calling all Rebels to join the fight this season. Starting after the April 22nd premiere, you'll hear 3 full breakdowns for each week's episodes of Andor Season 2. Each podcast will be led by one of our squadron leaders, Alicia, David, and John. We'll be bringing in new and familiar voices to fill out the roster. Search for the Lorehounds on any podcast platform to join us in a galaxy far, far away. And don't forget to check out our season pass for even more content like our Holocron bonus pods. It's good news for anyone, except Darth Vader.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Hi everybody, Mark here. This is not a sidetrack and this is not a regular episode. We've got a sidetrack coming out tomorrow, so check your feeds for that episode. This is a crossover podcast with the Lorehounds. You've probably heard us mention the Lorehounds before. We're a member of their network and they are a great podcast that does TV and movies and even some book content. Check them out because if you like this podcast, chances are you'd like their podcast and you'd like the media they're covering on their podcasts. They've even been cool enough to invite us onto their shows. I recently did an episode with Alicia Lorehound talking about the musical nominations for this year's Academy Awards. And Nicole's been on like 50 of their Severance pods because, well, she actually knows what she's talking about the brain. Anyways, in this bonus episode, Nicole and I talk with David Lorehound about the newly released Saturday Night Live music documentary, Ladies and Gentlemen, 50 Years of SNL Music. It's awesome, and I think the conversation's pretty awesome too. Check it out, and we'll see you tomorrow for your regularly scheduled sidetrack.
Welcome to the Lorehounds One Shots, or the Lorehounds, where every day is Saturday night and every stage is Studio 8H. I'm David.
I'm Mark from Nevermind the Music.
And I'm Nicole from Nevermind the Music.
And this is our special coverage of Questlove's new documentary, Ladies and Gentlemen, 50 Years of SNL Music. We're going to do this podcast a little different. We're going to have the hot take intro section on our main feed and then the whole episode over on Nevermind the Music. So if you're not already subscribed to that feed, just search for Nevermind the Music in your podcast application of choice. If you want to get in touch with us, there's a couple of options. You can send emails to lorehounds@thelorehounds.com or head over to our website, and then there you can use the voicemail feature or the contact form. Mark, if people want to get in touch with Nevermind the Music, how do they do that?
We're on most of the socials as Never Music Pod, and you can hit us up there or send us an email at nevermusicpod@gmail.com.
We're also pretty active on the Lorehounds Discord community. You can just search Nevermind the Music on that Discord and get involved in some really cool community discussions. We're having a pretty intense conversation about personality types right now, so hop on that. There's lots of great content on that feed.
And David, if our listeners don't know how to get to the Lorehounds Discord, where should they go?
Indeed. You could also just search for Lorehounds on your podcast app of choice if you want to get the feed. Otherwise, in the show notes of this episode, there will be a link tree. Click on that. You'll get to a webpage and it'll have all of our affiliates, all of our contact details, the Discord server. Everything will be there. Right. Nicole and Mark, this is pretty exciting to talk about this show. Before we get into the hot takes, I'm just a little bit curious as to both of your individual experiences or what is SNL to you and what What does it mean, Mark, for, are you a big watcher of the show?
I am not a big watcher of the show.
Okay.
Have always been one of those people who liked it, but always heard about things the next Monday morning or whatever, and would then somehow little by little catch the iconic moments. And so because of that, it kind of feels like the part of this documentary, I know we're going to cover hot takes later, but the part that resonated with me the most was all the Lonely Island stuff, especially like all the Andy Samberg stuff. And I was thinking about it later, and it's because of what I just told you, which is I was always an after the fact thing. And not only did that feel like just based on my age, that was kind of talking to me more than other eras might have been, but also
right.
That was early YouTube. That was the time when I could actually
right.
see, I would basically see all of their music videos after they came out without it just being kind of sporadic. Nicole, we just a couple of weeks ago, everybody heard our T-Pain episode. And I made this big deal about Sade and all that. And you were like, what? And I realized watching this doc, it's not because of T-Pain that was always associated
right.
with T-Pain. It was because of On a Boat. It was because of T-Pain being in Lonely Island that sort of I associate that nugget of pop culture with T-Pain and with comedy and with sort of the zeitgeist in general. So I've always had a retrospective relationship with Saturday Night Live, but that happens to have included, honestly, more often than not, musical stuff, whether it's a musical guest or a musical skit.
Nicole, are you a big SNL watcher or?
True to form, I definitely have my finger on the pulse of the zeitgeist a little bit more than Mark, that I watch SNL. I can't watch it live anymore because I'm old now and I can't stay up that late. But I watch it. I used to watch it live. It was like fun to stay up when I was younger and check it out. And also now I'll like watch it the next day on YouTube and actively seek it out. I love the Weekend Update. I find that it gives a great bit of levity. I love news parody stuff. So I've always been a fan of the Weekend Update. I've always been a fan of analyzing the writing process of SNL, the grind of it. I think that that's really cool. I just love the whole motif. So I'm a fan of SNL. I'm up to speed on it and I watch it frequently. And I'm also just a fan of Questlove. I think that he's really, really talented, obviously. And just this like well of creativity and people like that I find really inspiring. So that's like where I stand. I get it. I'm like following SNL for sure.
Cool. As a watcher of the original cast, you know, while it was on, in 1975, it's just sort of been a backdrop for a lot of my life. My strongest recollections of a particular cast or an era was the Eddie Murphy period. So while I have like fond memories of Dan Aykroyd and John Belushi, it's really the Eddie Murphy period that it sort of marks the show for me. And and I think like both of you, and I think we can maybe talk about this a little bit later, how we watch the show has changed a lot. Mm-hmm. And how we engage with it. You know, back when I was a kid, I remember, you know, there are episodes that we saw in this documentary that I don't remember because I wasn't there when it was on and there was no way to see the reruns. And now it's a completely different kind of delivery system. So, but I'm really just blown away that the fact that we're up to 50 episodes and this big weekend right now is happening as we're recording this. There's going to be a big concert and then there's going to be the 50th episode or, you know, season episode kickoff, which I think is going to be on Sunday. So that's
ha, 50 episodes, David, really?
Oh, ha, you got me. Sometimes my brain and my mouth are not always in sync. So a little setup for what we're going to be talking about, a documentary directed by Questlove. It's a 2-hour documentary exploring the Saturday Night Live's sort of half century of musical performances. It features a whole bunch of interviews with cast members and crew and people who are involved in the production, as well as a bunch of the different musical guests that have been on the show or had something to say about the show and about the show's impact on popular culture and music. So again, it's Questlove and Oz Rodriguez. So those are the two directors. And Oz Rodriguez is one of the producers on Saturday Night Live. Came out on January 27th on NBC. And then it's also available on Peacock for streaming. it's a documentary, so it doesn't get the same sort of ratings as Rotten Tomatoes and Metacritic and stuff. But IMDb has it rated as an 8.3 out of 10. So that's a pretty high score. Mark, what's your hot take for the documentary? What did you think of this as a piece of infotainment, as a piece of produced media?
I don't think this is a hot take. It's just fact. This is great. I don't know. Like, what kind, I mean, it's a love letter to SNL and a love letter to the music of SNL. Even if you don't watch SNL or don't like SNL, it is culturally important. And so I can't say, oh, it's a fact pretentiously like this doc is great. But the fact is, this is a way of tracking the history of the last half century, right? And whether it's through, you know, the Sinead O'Connor political stuff, the Rage Against the Machine political stuff, the comedians that have come and gone in terms of setting the comedic tone of entire generations, this doc, I thought, did an excellent job of capturing all of it. Kind of made me wish that I was watching live, right? And I know people have their favorite eras, and I don't think this era is most people's favorite era, but there's still sort of a magic to it that I think the creators of this documentary did an excellent job capturing. I don't know what else I can say except for that.
Are you a fan of Questlove in general?
Nicole, I know you've like read books and stuff he's written. Like, I haven't gone that far. But, you know, I mean, ever since The Roots, I've been, yeah, a fan of his work. His whole vibe is just a consummate collaborator, I think, is just such a cool vibe, especially when connected to something like this. That is really is a just perfect capsule of the chaos and magic of collaboration, whether it's the comics on the stage or the artists and the artists with the audience and all these cool things. I think he's the perfect person to capture this sort of adventure for us.
Nicole, you said that you're a big fan of Questlove. Tell us a little bit more about what it is that he does. I think he's a national treasure, and I'm so glad that we have so much more of his career left to experience, because he's not done by a long shot.
He doesn't seem done, and he seems so humble in his talent, and that is an awesome quality. He wrote this really great book called Creative Quest that I actually teach from that book about success and failure. Yeah, cool. Like, I assign chapters of it because it is a great reflection on how we don't really learn a lot from success, but we learn a ton from failure. And he kind of leans into the fact that every failure is just part of the creative process, and that I find that to be a really inspiring thought, especially with this generational cohort that's been taught that they're not allowed to fail. It's really cool to like, they're scared. They're so scared to fail. And Questlove always models the behavior that you can fail and keep trying and get better from that failure. So I find him really inspiring for sure. The idea of him as a collaborator is huge. I think he's very eager to work with people, and people seem to like to work with him. And that's reflective in this documentary. It's clear that he was like the creative voice behind it, especially, I know we'll talk about individual segments, but overarching, the way that they bin the content for this documentary was really impressive to me. It's so much to cover,
right?
There's so much. And I was wondering how they would find like a thread through it all. And they really did a great job of compartmentalizing certain aspects of Saturday Night Live to make a unified piece of content for us to observe. So, I don't know, not a hot take. It was a great documentary. I'm excited to watch it for a second time for sure, but it's long too. It was long.
2 hours, yeah. And it feels like it's almost cut up because the way they do they fly in the graphics and the logos every once in a while, feels like it's set up for commercial broadcast.
Yeah. Sure, it was probably 3 hours broadcast. Right.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because some of the material I pulled up was calling it 3 hours, but on the actual end-to-end runtime is 2 hours. So yeah, I think you're right. With commercial breaks, it pushed it to three.
I thought that was like a convention to kind of mirror the pace of Saturday Night Live.
Right.
That they like had those segment markers in place just to give the same rhythm.
Well, I think it perfectly overlaps, though, doesn't it? I mean, it creates that same same vibe and same feeling. And they used, I think, some of the graphics packages look like it's going back to the original 1975.
For sure.
And you talk about how much they covered, Nicole, like how could they do it? And granted, I'm not a true watcher, but of the iconic stuff I've encountered, you know, even like Wayne's World showed up briefly, right? And that's another way I've consumed Saturday Night Live, is through all the numerous films that have grown out of it.
Right.
But there's really only one thing, and I'm sure we're going to talk about this later, there's only one thing in terms of musical sketches, at least, that felt like it was left on the table and didn't appear. And I don't know if we're going to come back to that. But otherwise, it's amazing. It feels like they really got it all. And I'm sure hardcore fans will listen and be like, 10 things that should have been mentioned. But it's impressive what they did include in 2 hours, which is a long time, but not it's not the Get Back documentary. That's, you know, what is that, 9 hours long or something like that?
Right, that's a multi-day sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that took me a week to watch.
Exactly.
Something like that.
So I pulled together some background information on Saturday Night Live just to sort of help contextualize, you know, what this show is and represents. The show first premiered in October 11th, 1975. And the main guest was George Carlin, which is a pretty good guest to start with. And Billy Preston was the main musical guest. I don't know much about Billy Preston, Mark. Is he somebody that for you is...
It was funny for me to see Billy Preston. So Billy Preston's a really good keyboardist, songwriter. I know him primarily from two iconic cultural events. One of them is this one, of course. And that's what I was like, oh, cool. The other thing about Billy Preston that is sort of immortalized is he's the fifth Beatle on the rooftop concert and in Let It Be. So
wow.
I don't know his solo work, but if you watch...
I forgot about that.
That iconic rooftop concert video, he's the guy doing all the electric piano, and he's the electric piano and organ on the song Let It Be or Get Back or kind of that whole album. He's basically on almost every track, and it's one of these try to keep the band from killing each other moments, sort of like when they brought Eric Clapton in. And so I don't know his solo work, but I know him, you know, he was a pretty big guy back in the day and started as a hired gun keyboardist.
I forgot that he's totally in that, and they're talking about him and like, do we bring him in officially or not? And yeah,
they were almost going to add him in the band. But then this is a few years after that, right? This is probably five or six years after that. And so it's these other moments in history. I wish, you know, I knew his individual solo music, but it's sort of like, I wish he was the main character in history a little more. He feels a little bit more like he's appearing in other people's stories to mark historical events, like some kind of a Greek demigod or something like that.
Like a watcher from Fringe or something, you know?
Oh gosh, that takes me
back. Sorry, I'm like into Fringe.
You know, I mentioned in that Oscars episode, I mentioned Michael Giacchino doing weird violin effects and stuff. And I was literally thinking of the music from that show when I made that comment. So it's just one of those weeks. Anyways, cut that out. It's not good content.
Poor Billy Preston, huh? He really like didn't make the right choice. Did they kick him out of the Beatles or did he like elect to leave? What was the deal?
They mused about whether he should be added. I think, I don't remember, but one or two of the guys in the main band was strongly advocating for it. And then they sort of just didn't do it. I don't remember. There wasn't any big reason.
Oh,
so
bummer.
Back to Saturday Night Live.
They were breaking
really
up, so.
The show was developed by, so the studio came to Lorne Michaels and Dick Ebersol, and basically the issue was Johnny Carson, who was the big talk show host at the time, wanted to take one more night off a week, but he couldn't do that because they were doing reruns of his on Saturday night, and he wanted to take Fridays off, basically. And so they were like, well, we can't have two back-to-back reruns on, so we got to fill in something new for Saturday night. So that's how it got created. It was sort of backfiller so that Carson could have more days off. The first cast were nicknamed the Not Ready for Primetime Players, and that included Dan Aykroyd, John Belushi, Chevy Chase, Jane Curtin, Garrett Morris, Lorraine Newman, Gilda Radner, and George Coe. And I think the only original cast member that we talked to on this documentary is Jane Curtin. And I'm not sure where everybody else is. I don't know if many of them are still with us. I'd have to go and actually look. So a sketch comedy show isn't a new thing at this time, but it was the style and the format that was innovative, and the fact that it was live and it was produced and aired live. Apparently the first five seasons were, there was a lot of drug use. It was sort of the mid-70s, and cocaine was a big part of the working process for the show. In about 1980, Lorne Michaels, who is the main producer, left. There was a short period with a different producer, then Dick Ebersol took over. And he brought in Eddie Murphy and a bunch of other different talents, sort of revived the cast during the 80s. And then Lorne Michaels returned in 85 and then rebuilt and started rebuilding even further and carrying the show on to now. A couple of stats. So over 50 seasons, there have been 980 regular episodes. That's just the regular Saturday night episodes. There have been 970 musical guest appearances. So there were 10 episodes that didn't have a musical guest. But by the best I could figure out, there have been about 1,400, maybe 1,440, 1,450 musical guests, individual guests that have been on the show. And that may be a musical guest who is hosted, because sometimes they do that. They double up. The host right. is the musical guest. There are other times where multiple musical guests are joining together. So that's two different artists who are playing together. So, you know, almost 1,500 musicians or musical people have been on the show. And that's over a span of 167 different cast members over these 50 seasons.
So I really appreciate you watching all of that content, all 50 seasons to get that data, David.
Right.
That's super
and like
helpful.
Counting everybody. Yeah. Wow. Right. That's really
Are you
impressive.
Sure you didn't mess up and miscount, like
I
double count somebody?
I'm sure it's been messed up. I won't tell you how I came to those numbers, but I had a little silicon help to crunch the data. But all that, if you go on Wikipedia, every season has a page, every guest, every musical guest, it's all there. And so you can sort of dig through it. So you can fall down a very big hole. But I just think that when we think about the fact that 980 regular episodes, and that doesn't mean the specials or all the spinoffs and everything like that, and over, you know, almost 1,500 musical guests, the impact on culture and what the show represents, as you were saying, Mark, this and what this documentary represents as this time capsule, this incredible record, this incredible love letter to something that has been so influential in culture. And we'll talk about some more details once we get into the episode proper. But it's astonishing to me. And then, I had a little bit of online help calculating those numbers. But imagine Oz Rodriguez and Questlove watching. Like, how did they go about going to like figure out what they were going to do?
Can we talk about the opening yet?
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about that, and then we'll take a break.
Oh my gosh, everybody, stop what you're doing. The medley, the musical montage, the mashup, as people used to say a decade ago, of who knows how many songs from live performances put together in a more than 5 minutes long segment. I think it's like 6 or 7 minutes.
Dude, it was so long that I was like, is this the whole documentary? Because I went in kind of blind. I was like, is this just 2 hours of this? I was like, that would be awesome.
So the reason, yeah, totally. The reason that I thought about it when you were just saying that, David, is, yeah, they had to comb through the footage to think of what they were going to talk about. They had to comb through somebody. I don't know. We have to probably shout out whoever did the editing of this thing. They combed through all of some of these iconic performances and they mashed them up. And so I'm thinking of all these things as I'm just struck by the majesty of this moment. Like, did they change the key of this? Did they pitch shift it so it would fit with the next song? Or is it just do they have AI look through and say, how many performances are at this beats per minute? And they just... Because it basically goes as one seamless track, one seamless song that is all essentially the same tempo with a few breaks that maybe they were time stretching a little bit of it, but they had to have found anything that fit. And there's moments where, like Losing My Religion, the vocal alone is above some other song. There's a moment where there's like a call and response between Super Freak and Girls on Film.
Oh my gosh, so good.
So good. And it's just, this is one of those things. I just don't think people know how hard that is to do.
I was watching it and I was like, Mark is losing his mind right now watching this, because it is like, how do you even start? Where do you even get started? There were so many mashups that were awesome.
I'm going to shout out.
That's crazy.
Yeah, sorry.
Crazy.
I'm going to shout out the Weird Algorithm podcast, which is a Weird Al podcast. And they talk about his polkas. Weird Al will do like, and I want to actually bring up Weird Al later, but they'll do these polkas where he goes through like 20 pop songs at the same time. And the craft, they always talk about how the craft of doing that is so tough to do. But to medley through artifacts like this, through footage, some of it, and audio tracks from some of which are, 50 years old, some of which are only 5 to 10 years old, is just makes even writing a polka medley like Weird Al look like a tiny task. I can't imagine, people, I'm telling you, that was probably 50 hours to make. Just that thing.
What was your favorite mashup, Mark? I know you have it. Can you guess mine?
Gosh, no. I can't guess yours because I don't remember enough. Like, I was just kind of taking it all in. The Losing My Religion one was the one where I realized they're doing something on the next level here.
That's me in the corner, that's me in the spotlight, losing my religion.
Hey baby, it's you.
Because it was two disparate things that just didn't go together. I did not make a note of which one hit me the hardest, though. Nicole, what did you think?
I loved the Bobby McFerrin TLC part because I just love TLC. And you forget how good Bobby McFerrin is. And I know that you have a history in a cappella and that you're very passionate about it. But he has kind of obviously that kind of flavor. It was so good. Cher and Hanson was a really great mashup for me because the juxtaposition was just so funny. Dave Matthews Band and Queen mashed up together. I made a note that that was really cool for me.
You walked away when I needed you most. Now baby, 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 I found someone to justify you. To take up my duty. To justify, come on, to take away the lonely day. To justify you.
It was awesome to see two very different styles of artists combine, and I think that that's very representative of the nature of Saturday Night Live, that we're pulling a lot of different things from a lot of different areas, and it's like throwing it together and it's working, recognizing that that intro was not thrown together. I'm not sure how you would even get started on an undertaking like that. And when I thought to myself, is this going to be 2 hours of mashups? Like, I'm on board, but that is a tremendous amount of work.
My wife and I were watching, and she's a huge Saturday Night Live fan. She still watches today. She watches the YouTube clips, and she's a big music fan as well. We were just stunned at the incredible work that taking not only the audio tracks, but the video tracks.
Right.
And then seamlessly integrating them. And then they flowed perfectly. And it was, I just couldn't believe what I was hearing or seeing. It was beyond understanding. I mean, it's 6 minutes of this musical history.
I don't feel like, as dripping with praise we are, I don't think we're doing it justice. Like, if you haven't seen it, right. Is there a way to just see that? Like, that's worth the price of admission alone. So, yeah. Like, check it out, people. It's just a thing of beauty. And it starts out just with the ladies and gentlemen. You think it's just going to be kind of like a talky thing. And then suddenly the music starts. And
ladies and gentlemen.
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 And now, ladies and gentlemen.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Saturday.
New York.
Jolt of electricity.
Iconic.
Musical history. Game changing for a network show.
Sorry, ladies and gentlemen.
Here we go.
Excitement. Energy.
Adrenaline.
Live.
Absolutely fucking terrifying.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Saturday night.
I'm on SNL and you're not.
Even the ladies and gentlemen was on beat and had rhythm to it and had timbre to it. Right. And, you know, it was like setting up for something. It was the metronome of it all. And
but there was no way to expect that until it hits.
Right.
Until you're on this musical journey. And then what I thought was really interesting is they sort of transition and then they start talking to people. And then one of the things that they do there is you start having these short little conversations with a whole bunch of the people that are going to be voices in the documentary later.
Yeah.
So he's pre-setting us up to see these people come back later, which is a really great documentary technique as well, right? So like 3/4 of the documentary, you're like, oh, who is this person? We're so far into this and now you're bringing me a new voice. So they sort of prime the pump for us to see who are some of the people that we're going to engage with and get their points of view on the show. And so I thought that was just, again, really smart documentary filmmaking.
Okay, I've just looked up on IMDb. I just want to shout out the actual editors. There's a whole credit here. There's the editors who do the doc, but then there's music montage editor. And there are three people who I want to shout out. James Lester, John McDonald, and Oz Rodriguez. So,
okay, and Oz is one of the main, the director along with Questlove for the overall thing. And he's also a producer on Saturday Night Live.
He probably watched a lot of footage.
And just imagine all of the people who were involved in pulling up these archival footage and the material and queuing that up. And it's just an incredible effort. And I'm so proud of them. I'm so proud for them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like this medley is a work of art in and of itself. Forget the rest of the documentary. This 6 minutes of musical history is just phenomenal. Well, I think we're done gushing for now. So from here, we're going to take a quick break. And then if you're on the main Lorehounds feed, this is where the podcast is going to end. And if you want to hear the rest of the podcast, we're going to get into more of the details. Go over to Nevermind the Music, subscribe over there, and you can listen to the rest of the conversation. So thanks for joining us on this. I hope you get a chance to see the documentary and see you over Nevermind the Music.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
So are we talking about the sax stuff now, or are we saving that?
Yeah, I think we should.
All right. That's such a cool lick, and it's so interesting when you listen to the different versions of the theme. It occurs in different parts of the composition. Like, it's kind of always there, but sometimes it sort of starts you off. Sometimes it takes a few seconds for it to enter. Sometimes it even sort of seems to start on a different beat. And this is just the most sax player-y sax thing ever. It's using all sorts of, I guess you could call them extended techniques. This is a term that came up in the Oscar episode we did recently. That's a bent note, right? That's like a blue note, you could say. It uses the altissimo register, which is for a tenor sax, which by the way, Lenny Pickett is the music director and he's playing the sax in that clip in the documentary. That's a really high note. They call it altissimo. It's kind of technically out of the range of the sax, but people have found a way. Life finds a way, as Dr. Ian Malcolm said. And it's this theme. There's also flutter tonguing. This is the stuff that like somebody would do at a doctoral recital to get their DMA, as they would say, in saxophone performance. But there just happens to be in the 70s and 80s is this sort of heyday in some ways of the sax as an expressive tool, right? Because it's really more of a jazz thing before that. And so the jazz players, of course, before that, starting with swing and then up through, still in the 70s and 80s, jazz players are using the sax. But I feel like it's that era when you see it in pop music and you see stuff that really is almost outrageous happening in a lot of conventional music. And this theme is very jazzy in a lot of ways, but just the fact that that sound was being heard by everybody every Saturday night, you know, in this connection to the kind of New York underground art scene anyways that this show had, it's just such a perfect little, they talk about the chaos of the theme in right. the, of right. that nobody can sing it, right? Because it's got all this weird stuff. And it also just that the sound of that instrument feels like it's iconic to the era in so many ways.
Nicole, I was just struck by the idea of improvisation in jazz music, but then also from a branding standpoint, from a psychology of when we hear a theme song or we see a logo, we identify with that product.
Right. And this is such a standout sound. Like you hear that and you think of Saturday Night Live. But
it doesn't have a medley that you can, a melody that you can play back in your head.
You can't be like, O'Reilly.
Exactly.
Or whatever.
Sure.
It's not catchy.
But I'll also add, there was a moment in the documentary that they asked people to sing the theme song, which was hilarious. And yes, you can't remember and you can't sing it because there isn't a true melody. But I even think I think it might have been Billie Eilish or someone said, I'm too stressed out to even be listening to the theme song. Whenever I hear the theme song, I just start getting stressed out because it triggers
on the show. Yeah.
You're about to kind of just go from 0 to 60 and keep grinding for an hour, right?
Live.
Right. So we know that when you're stressed out and your amygdala is hyperactive, your brain isn't remembering stuff. You don't have good emotional or memory recall around those moments anyway. So it could be a combination of things. Yeah, we can't remember the theme song because it's improvised. There isn't any track to follow. But also you might not be able to remember it if you're an actor on that show because you're just stressed out whenever you hear it. So
I think too, from an audience standpoint, knowing that it was live, I was nervous for them as well. And that was, I think, part of the excitement was the fact that this is live comedy. This is
right.
scripted, but also improvisational and things can happen. And I love, they spent a bunch of time on the documentary talking about the parallels between comedy and music. And there's, they introduce these ideas of timing and cadence and misdirection and performance energy. Mark, I was thinking of you when I heard them talking about this in terms of live performance, but then this bridging between comedy and music, this fusion of these techniques. It's even not at this cultural level, but it's at this sort of musical performance level.
I think we should talk about just musical comedy in general for a bit, but just
sure.
to what you're saying, just the idea, the little that I know about improvisation in a, comedic or theatrical performance sense, not musical, is there's this idea of yes and, right? You kind of accept what's happening and you go with the flow and you add instead of pull back. You don't ever take something away. You just keep adding to it. That's my understanding of it, at least. And there's something about the sort of, we just have to make this work, that has a lot in common with music, but also in music in this show. Rage Against the Machine are going to do what they do, and they can maybe try to stop it, but maybe they're not going to be able to stop it. And you just kind of have to say, well, that's live TV. And so I think there's a synergy there in the sort of, we are a team and we are generating this experience together, sometimes through improvisation, but always through immediacy, that is happening with comedy and is happening group comedy, at least, and is happening with music, but also just the nexus of doing it live at the show amplifies that in both media totally in a massive way to me.
And Nicole, I know I've known a few people who've been involved in media, product TV, movie. I've a couple of high school friends who are actually in movies. You can go find them, you can see them and everything.
Cool.
So I've hung out with them and stuff, and when they got into improv, it was like a way of life for them. This
right.
whole yes and philosophy.
It's hard to turn it off, I think, for some of those folks. I bet you it's hard to go from being an improvisational comic to being an actor that works from a script. And I wonder, a lot of the skits on SNL like branched out to movies, and I wonder how much improvisation happened on the set of those movies to make them really funny. My guess is a lot, mm-hmm. because it is a certain motif in comedy. And I don't think a highly valued one. Like I always think about like the social hierarchy of everything. I wonder in comedians, like, where's the social hierarchy? Because improv comic, are they low on the totem pole?
Yeah, I don't know.
And like stand up might be top tier. I don't know. I think about that.
Mm.
I wonder. Don't tell your high school friends.
I think, well, first of all, obviously there isn't like improv. This is not an improv troupe, right? So
right.
as improvisational as the generation of some of these ideas might be, including the sax theme, it's still a sax theme that they established. And these are still skits that they are curating over really agonizing 5 or 6 days of creation. But it's their reactions are immediate and they still have to play off the moment. I mean, we're watching a lot of crazy moments happening in this documentary that were not planned, right? I'm sure a lot of the musical performances and the skits went off and they knew exactly what the audience would think and they knew exactly what would happen. And those aren't the ones that are being discussed and being remembered, I think, because it's when things break a little bit past your expectation, whether the audience loved it more or it was Ashley Simpson, the equipment messing up, or like,
oh my gosh,
when there's something that doesn't go perfect is kind of when the magic happens, whether it's good or bad, right? At a certain point, maybe.
Right. I'm curious a little bit too about these parallels, like misdirection techniques. They talked about this at the beginning of the documentary. I never thought about that in terms of music composition and how an artist will sort of lead you one way and then flip it and then bring you back. And then that's actually what is interesting in the song is that reversal of direction.
There's so many ways you can look at that could be true, right? Whether it's a chord you think is going to go one way and then you substitute something else, or a section that there's a key change and it surprises you, or, you know, combining genres. I think there are tricks. I mean, even music production is about audio illusions, right? You're highlighting certain tracks. You're killing some things so that other things may live. You're doing things to kind of misdirect the audience so that you can control what they're listening to. And in some ways that probably is a bit like comedy or sketch writing. And I think to the point of so much of this comedy and maybe just musical comedy in general, so much of it is about incongruous things, right?
Right.
Mm. So you've got the dad at his daughter's wedding and he's about to perform. This is one of the greatest sketches.
Fred Armisen.
Fred Armisen.
Oh my
the
gosh.
Greatest sketches ever. And you think he's going to sing with his old band this sentimental love song, and then they're in a hardcore punk band.
All right, let's do this. Madeline, my little Maddie, I'm so proud of you. And I hope Dad doesn't make too much of a fool of himself up here. All right, it's with all my love. You guys ready? Here we go.
1, 2, 3, 4, this one!
We're a crisis of conformity, thank you.
The thing about it is the lyrics don't need to be funny.
Right.
The lyrics don't matter. And I think that's where a lot of musical comedy struggles is first of all, the music needs to still be good. And second of all, it's the context around that music that makes it funny. Yes, you can write funny songs, but most effective musical comedy, in my opinion, is more about having something be disjointed, something not quite feeling what you expect, whether it's the misdirection you're mentioning, David, or in this case, just the absurdity that we're watching of this wedding band, and it's a hardcore punk band and dedicating it to his daughter, and then they're screaming, right?
Dude, the name of the band is so good. Crisis of Conformity.
Right, yeah.
That's the name of the band. It's so funny because weddings are such like...
And everybody's in tuxedos and formal dresses. And
it's the satire. And that's something, a theme that comes up a lot in this documentary that I love, that when we talk about the musical aspect of SNL, the fact that you can be funny, but it's funnier if the music's good. Like, it's funnier that the music's good and they're out of context and they're in this punk band at the wedding and it's satirical and weird. And like Dave Grohl's awesome. And Fred Armisen is actually singing, and you know he sings in a punk band, right? So all of that adds value. And we see that later I know we'll talk about the Lonely Island stuff. We have to, right? But when Timberlake comes in and he's like, you know what, guys, I'm actually going to let's produce it. Let's like really do it because it's funnier if we do it right. And I think that SNL has always honored the creative process and, you know, going back to Questlove, sure has. But honoring the artistry of things and not just looking for a cheap joke, really trying to make it good. And I just, yeah, for sure. We see that absolutely in that punk band.
And then that gets us into this crossover of marker. Sorry. Look at that marker.
Me too. Let it out, everybody.
That gets us into that crossover too, when we have, so we have musicians that we have to talk about in these notable cultural moments, but then just looking at this one particular aspect of these crossovers between not only artists, but the cast that this thing spawned, like you were saying, Nicole, when the music is good, it makes the comedy good. Mm-hmm. And we have the Blues Brothers with Belushi and Aykroyd. We have Wayne's World. We have Adam Sandler. We have Fred Armisen. We have Lonely Island. Then, of course, you know, one of the absolute all-time favorites.
Are you sure that was sounding okay?
I'll be honest, fellas, it was sounding great, but I could have used a little more cowbell.
So it's just the integration between music and comedy is phenomenal. I don't know, this would be a good time to talk about Lonely Island now. But if you want to talk about Sandler or Armisen or Blues Brothers, then I think we should go for it.
Can we just ask why that wasn't like, by the way, One Hit Thunder, that another friend of the podcast, they talked about this. How is the cowbell clip not, that is just the funniest thing and so iconic musically. Can we think of any reason why? Are they feuding with Walken? Like, what's the deal? Or,
Walken's like severed right now, so he can't.
That's right.
He can't be on a podcast. And,
all these dated references.
You mean not having him on the? Why they didn't have Walken on the documentary?
Just why is the more cowbell clip not mentioned? As it is just so to me, that's one that just has come up as a meme for years, and maybe right. It's just musicians. Right. Everybody, anytime anybody ever plays the cowbell, someone says. More cowbell. It's kind of the Run Forest Run of the music scene that it's just
maybe Walken,
so ubiquitous.
Yeah. Maybe he's sick of it. Maybe he's like, can you stop? Can you st-? Like every time I have this giant catalog of artistic work, my whole life's work, and it's minimized to more cowbell whenever maybe.
Well, I think what also sells it though is where Will Ferrell.
Yes.
He's all in on the bit.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Physically. Right.
Like when the glasses come off. It's so funny.
And it's one of those things. It's the Luke, I am your father, misremembered thing, right? He doesn't say that, but we've all remembered. Don't Fear the Reaper doesn't have that much. It's not like it's got cowbell, but we've all, if I'm playing that track in my mind right now, it's going gong, 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 because it's been overwrites your actual memory of the song. Right. That's how iconic it is.
Yeah.
But I didn't mean what you really brought up. Like you were using that. You play that clip, but then you were trying to transition us somewhere else. I'm trying to remember what you were.
Well, just into this idea.
Lonely Island.
Well, yeah, we can talk about Lonely Island. We could talk about any of these. I think the point is that this crossover is that when you bisect or intersect music and comedy in this way, it does create these incredibly powerful vehicles for not only the artists, but these particular moments. So again, just sort of running through a very short list, Blues Brothers, Wayne's World, Adam Sandler, Fred Armisen, Lonely Island. Any of those things are, we could have whole separate podcasts about.
Well, if I know Mark, he really is eager to talk about the Lonely Island
stuff. Let's talk about
it. Well, it's like right up your alley. But
we already have a little bit, but can we just say some of these people are legitimately good, right? And this goes back, I mentioned Weird Al earlier. The reason Weird Al's funny is because he's also good and his band is good.
Right?
It's not junk music. That's just a joke. But John Belushi, Eddie Murphy, Maya Rudolph, like these people legitimately can sing and can perform. They probably did when they were younger, before they were professional comics, probably also were performers, and it just makes such a difference. You know, Sandberg's not as good as Timberlake, but he's got a vibe that can carry it while you leave the wow and all that stuff to JT. And I mean, just the Lonely Island is like when I realized that Justin Timberlake was awesome, because to me, Justin Timberlake before that, sure, I liked some of his songs like Rock Your Body or whatever, his solo stuff, but the guy from NSYNC, no thank you to Mark. Like 20-something Mark was not going to be about. And then I watched that, and then I see him again in other videos. He almost was practically a member of SNL for a little while there, considering he was in so many iconic... I know he wasn't, right. But he has to have been on SNL 10 times or something.
And his stuff with Fallon is so funny, too. The stuff that the two of them do together is iconic and super funny.
Sure. And it's just... It's so... You can make a pop star so cool with the right connection to SNL, I feel like. But anyways, I mean, I don't have that much to say about Lonely Island. It's just the early, and I know it's not that early internet, but the early viral video internet, certainly in the mid-2000s, it's just such a representative of that. And it works because the music is well-produced, JT right. said, right?
There's one name I just realized that's not on here because he wasn't in the documentary, and I don't know why. But obviously, there's probably a lot of rights-related issues. I mean, they had to get... I don't know what kind of permissions and agreements and everything like that, but Steve Martin's not mentioned on here. I mean, he hosted five times, but that was, you know, his whole shtick, his whole musical shtick was put on a rocket booster because of Saturday Night Live, right?
Yeah.
He's a fantastic.
Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah. He's a great musician as well. There's a great two-part documentary out about Steve Martin that just came out last year.
I love Whose Line Is It Anyway? I love Wayne Brady. But the least funny moments of Whose Line Is It Anyway is when they improvise a song, because they're singing something funny is not enough to make it really funny. It takes the context that we're talking about, right? And it's the contradictions of some of these moments with the cast interacting with the guest that just creates such gold. There was another one that popped into my head and I can't remember.
I have a list of some of my favorite ones that I'd love to share.
Yeah, I'm definitely curious to hear what you got.
I think that the I'm on a boat is really classic for me. Every time I'm on a boat, I have to reference, I'm on a boat. It's hilarious. Right. The Let's Do It In My Twin Bed is really funny. It's very like an En Vogue callback. I love how they are satires of 90s R&B. So like even Dick in the Box sounds really hard to say that and sound academic. You know, when they reference Color Me Bad as the musical guest.
Oh my God.
And then you see them dressed in their costumes for that bit. It's like, oh, they were modeling after Color Me Bad. And I loved Color Me Bad growing up. So that's probably why I love that song so much. And I also thought the Single Ladies video was really great, too. And I know that wasn't a Lonely Island parody, but it just speaks to
this idea. It was the Lonely Island vibe.
Right. And their vibe was meant to be like lo-fi and nostalgic. And then when you get Beyonce involved, you kind of, that goes away, right? So the vibe shifted a little bit. But even just Justin Timberlake talking about how he had to get buy-in from Beyonce, and the way he did it was he just went to her dressing room wearing the unitard. I just love how Saturday Night Live gives a space for people that take themselves seriously to like be unserious.
Right.
And I think that that's like healthy and always fun as a viewer to watch because it takes you by surprise. You know, that Beyonce was on board with that.
But that's what I mean about Justin Timberlake, that he's like a part when you host or when you do this, you don't just show up and play. You become a part of the creative process for so many days, right? And so for whatever reason, the idea that Justin Timberlake would be the person that would have to convince Beyonce is just because they're both like pop stars. Beyonce maybe has eclipsed him at that in that moment. Certainly, he's not Lorne Michaels. Like it's not his job to do that, but he does it. He puts on the costume and sells the bit. That the fact that people put themselves on the line when they do this show, whether it's just because of the possibility of something going wrong or just like that. He spent Beyonce might have thought he was lame for the rest of his life based on that one moment. He risked it all in this behind the scenes moment.
Just to be like committed to the bit.
Yeah, that's right.
Committed to the bit.
And that's not just, oh, that's why I think Justin Timberlake is cool now. It's also just part of why SNL is cool. That everybody kind of wants to be a part of one of those moments and they're willing to do who knows what to do it. And not in a bad way, not in a, like a Jerry Springer, I'll do anything on TV just to get on TV. They're like, they're in it for as a part of a team and it feels great.
Well, I think that swings nicely over into another topic that we can talk about in terms of some of the iconic musicians who were not only on the show, but parodied on the show. Mm-hmm. And so some of the things, Joe Cocker is because of John Belushi's impression of him. Frank Sinatra with Joe Piscopo doing, like that was a whole bit that he did for years and years was his Sinatra. James Brown, obviously, with Eddie Murphy and his impersonation.
Stevie Wonder.
Which, you know, is incredible. And then, of course, you have Joe Piscopo and Eddie Murphy doing their Ebony and Ivory spoof.
Excuse me, Mr. Sinatra, sir. He's here.
Patrolman.
Yes, sir.
Stevie Wonder. You are aptly named. Like I said many times, you are truly a wonder.
Thanks a lot, Frank.
I am dark and you are light.
You are blind as a bat, then I have sight.
Ebony and ivory, just living in perfect harmony.
We're talking salt and pepper, Sammy and Dean.
And I forget who was the cast member they were talking to at this particular moment. She was like, I don't know Joe Cocker from, you know, Bob Smith down the street. But I know Joe Cocker because John Belushi did Joe Cocker. Hmm. And that transmitted something to me in a way that was even more than what Joe Cocker's stick was, right? Or what his thing was. And for me, like, again, with like Eddie Murphy doing James Brown and Stevie Wonder, I learned more about those two artists than I would have because Eddie Murphy was doing so well.
You could say that a lot about impressionists in general. I mean, how many Sarah Palin quotes are in your head that are actually probably not actually spoken by her?
Exactly.
But are Tina Fey parodies on SNL in the same era, right?
Right. Exactly.
But like your brain just kind of, I don't know, Nicole, tell us how that's happening. Like you're, it feels, those memories feel authentic, even though you don't necessarily, it's not real, even though it's not real
it's
life.
Not it's not real. It's just like,
Palin.
Like exposure and exposure and exposure. And you start making these connections that, you know, you equate Tina Fey with Sarah Palin some way. And whenever you just make the association, and it's been retrained and retrained and retrained in your brain over time that you do start to think of them as the same, like the Venn diagram closes over time. It's really cool. Totally. And really interesting.
Isn't it called, what is it called? The Mandela effect?
So that's when we misremember.
As a group.
A group. I think nobody remembers people who thought Nelson Mandela had died in the 80s when, in fact, he was released from prison and became the president of South Africa, right?
Or like the Berenstain Bears versus the Berenstain Bears and how it could be labeled differently.
Didn't we have a Mandela effect on one of our episodes?
We talked about it.
I think
something.
Because it happened. There was something in a song. Gosh, I wish I could remember.
Who even knows? Who even knows what we talk about?
Is this real life, Nicole? I don't know.
Poor David's trying to keep us on track here. We're spiraling. No.
This is the Lorehounds. This is Neverminds the Music. This is what we're...
I think, though, if we're talking about the musical guests for a bit, it sounded like you were trying to transition us to that.
I think after the break, we'll talk about Saturday Night Live as a signal booster, a cultural signal booster. And then we'll talk about some more of those iconic moments musically that happened.
Right.
But I at some point, we had to talk about swinging from the comedy music aspect over it and really address the fact of the Stevie Wonder impersonations or the Frank Sinatra impersonations and what they did musically and comedically for us.
About the impersonations, I sound like who I sound like, but there are vocal affectations that artists have. And fundamentally, I think an impressionist, certainly a musical one, is a really good listener, right? Mm. Because most people, if you ask them to sing back a famous song, they're just going to sing the melody, right? They'll spend all their neural energy on trying to get the melody and the rhythm and the tone right and all that. But in reality, the things that make a musician, specifically a singer, so recognizable and iconic is the things that go beyond that. And sometimes even the things that aren't objectively good, the things they're doing that are not, quote, normal, the things that are abnormalities give them their character. So whether it's some artists who breathe really loud or like, you know, it's not a vocal tone. If someone wanted to do an impression of, I don't know, let me say like Michael Jackson or whatever, it wouldn't be by singing a note. It would be by going, right? It would be the thing that isn't the music really. It's the other things. And I choose him because it's kind of, He's maybe one of the most iconic voices just alone. And so if you're thinking about what is Eddie Murphy doing to sound like Stevie Wonder, it's he's listening. There's like a certain vowel shape that Stevie Wonder does that nobody else is doing that he's able to mimic. And sure, he's got the high notes somehow that Stevie Wonder has. I can't believe Eddie Murphy can sing like that. But there's just a sort of manner to it that he can do. And then he puts it with the visual and you're sold, right? He'll do the thing with his body, right?
Do you want to know what's happening in your brain?
Yes.
Like, to do all that?
Of course we do. For us or for the person who is doing the impression?
For us as a viewer. So when you make a new memory, what happens is information is coming into your brain and into your hippocampus. And your hippocampus is like deciding where to put it in your brain to make little little markers to consolidate around one memory. So when you're in a new space, right, your parietal lobe is looking at the spatial, like the stuff that's around you, and your occipital lobe is looking at the visuals around you, and the frontal lobe is looking at what you're doing when you're in that space. So when you form a memory, your hippocampus is like shuttling information to all these different parts of your brain and then consolidating them together to form a memory. So even if one little thing is off, you'll still like make the memory. So for impressions, even if the vocals are a little bit off, but the visuals are strong and the body movements are strong, and they're around people or in a visual space that it looks like that person would exist in real life, your brain kind of fills in the blanks and like makes a memory around it. And that could be also part of the reason that we remember Sarah Palin as Tina Fey as Sarah Palin, because there's just enough information there for our hippocampus to like stitch together and make a memory.
Okay, in Eddie Murphy's case, I think he's blessed with an instrument that happens to be capable of doing the Stevie Wonder stuff.
You've got to be good, right? You have to have some kind of musical talent to be able to do that impersonation.
But like no amount of practice could he maybe sound like Ozzy Osbourne or something. Like his instrument is built for certain kinds of things,
right? Yeah.
So like he just happens for Stevie Wonder or James Brown, like his voice just fits really well, whereas maybe he couldn't do, you know, Barry White, right? He just has a different kind of voice. But.
Well, and there's a reason why he wasn't doing Mick Jagger or, you know, I mean, regardless of a skin color issue, just like he doesn't have the voice for Mick Jagger.
But Jimmy Fallon sure does. Jimmy Fallon's a shoo-in.
By the way, you look great.
No, we look great.
Oh,
yeah.
Hey, let's go over pointed fingers again, okay?
Yeah, cool.
Okay. And I'm pointing my fingers. Pointing at you.
But I wonder, though, looking at these as visual comedic moments, right, not just audio, if you weren't watching Belushi do Joe Cocker, you weren't seeing him flail around on the stage next to him, would it sound as much like him, right? That's a question, right? Because we mentioned misdirection before. There might be things about these impressionist voices that aren't the same. There's only so much you can do, but they sell it through enough things. And so I wonder if you take away any one element, does it still work? I don't know. The visual sells it. The vocal tone of the actual vocal instrument that person owns in their body sells part of it. And then the listening carefully to their nuances and their imperfections and characteristics is the third piece.
I know more about Joe Cocker's musical style because John Belushi introduced it to me. And then so when I would see Joe Cocker actually, I'm like, he doesn't do it as good as John Belushi does. There was something polished and, you know, because it's performative and pushed to this extra degree, it's almost more better in some ways when Eddie Murphy does the James Brown scream.
Because James Brown is another good example of someone.
And how do you
Michael
go from
Jackson, but
Stevie Wonder's beautiful, smooth pipes to James Brown's?
Yeah.
You know,
well, but,
incredible.
But James Brown, with all of his kind of almost non-musical expressive things, right, with his voice that aren't singing really, they're like things around singing. Not all of those things happen in every song. James Brown. So if you're listening to James Brown song, you're not going to necessarily, and that goes for the singing, that also goes for the instrumental aspects of all of his songwriting, all that stuff. But in a parody, you're probably going to put all of them into one song.
Right,
you're going to have every single thing that artist does in a song. And so it feels almost like a more pure version almost of in our heads what that artist is, even if it's obviously not real. Right. And so it's one of those, again, Weird Al, when he does a parody of a style of an artist, it's rarefied. And I'm not the first person to say, like, to hear Devo do the Weird Al, real Devo do the Weird Al Devo parody song would be like actually the most Devo song possible, if that makes sense. Because the Weird Al Devo song called Dare to Be Stupid, which is not an actual parody of a specific Devo song, it is a parody of Devo in general. If Devo were to play it, it like has everything Devo's ever done in 3 minutes in some level, right? And that's what some of these, none of Dick in the Box is more absurd than any early 90s romantic song. It has all those elements though that kind of feels authentic, but if you actually compared it to some early 90s, obviously it's a little more vulgar than most of that would have been, but even musically it has all of it in a way that none of them actually would have had anyways, right?
It's like,
or
so
I'm on a Boat is more T-Pain than any one T-Pain song could possibly be, right?
Because it's so stereotypical and archetypal about that genre, like it's taking it's boiling down the genre to be like the most iconic and accessible pieces, stripping the nuance in a way that doesn't, I don't mean that pejoratively, but it's just, it's boiling it down to the truest essence, just to the point of satire, but not 100% satirical because it's generally good music.
And what's hilarious about the Lonely Island guys is they're a bunch of nerdy white kids who grew up on all this black culture and then synthesizing it back into something that is not only it's homage as much as it is anything, right? It's
like when they talk about The Chronic and they're saying like The Chronicle of Narnia. Like,
oh my God. Yeah, that kills me.
So funny.
Well, let's take a quick break. Let's take a quick break. And then when we come back, we'll talk about this intersection between the cultural impact and evolution of how, you know, Saturday Night Live is this cultural signal booster in a way. And then we'll also get into some of the more transformative performances of things that really shook society. All right, and we're back. So we were just talking about how culturally comedy and music, and when they come together, how they affect us as an individual, but then culturally what they do. And I think one of the really interesting things about the Saturday Night Live documentary, what this documentary does, is it talks about how the show itself is a signal booster to culture. And so that they were picking acts that were just on the cusp that were unknown, or the fact that hip hop basically was introduced to mainstream American culture on Saturday Night Live. And that it's just an incredible place and space for artists to push forward and break forward. I mean, I think we get a lot of big headline artists now, but I mean, maybe back then, a lot of these artists were unknown or just on the edge of being known.
I think a lot of that has to be connected to the 70s New York City thing, right?
Right.
So there, whether there was the uptown scene, downtown scene, I always mess this up, the kind of experimental music scene of, I think downtown scene, of the 60s that starts, but then we have punk, you know, CBGB, all that stuff happening in New York, and then hip hop being born.
Disco.
And there wasn't, and disco, right? That's right. And that stuff wasn't all necessarily separate. Mm. The punks would maybe go and check out some of the hip hop stuff, right? And, you know, they talked a lot about Debbie Harry, right? Kind of being a part of both of those scenes, both the punk scene and the hip hop. And she's the reason that the Funky 4 Plus 1, you know, got there.
Oh, sorry, Funky 4, not Fab 4,
We gotta prove to the world that we're for real. We gotta prove to everybody we know the real deal. We got golden voices, our hearts are still. We got the 5 MCs, we got to be real. We wanna get a party, people yell sugar.
At that time, we didn't know the impact of what we did to become the first rap group, you know, to ever be on national television. That is the beginning of everything. just learn the culture, learn how all of this came. There's a saying, you know, that Grandmaster has always said, hip-hop didn't invent anything, but we reinvented everything.
And there's just something kind of punk rock about it in that early sense, in the general sense, not literally punk rock, but I mean, Captain Beefheart played. I mean, he's an experimental musician. They had Frank Zappa on. Someone, the equivalent of those guys would not be on that show now. They just wouldn't be. And that's really cool. And because to what extent, I don't know, I'm not a scholar of comedy, but to what extent was this considered sort of alternative comedy at the time, right? Were they already offbeat? And so they were friends with offbeat. Like Belushi would be friends with the guy and a fan of a hardcore punk band like Fear. I feel like this is all kind of mixed up, right? These folks were not the mainstream comics necessarily. Am I wrong about that? I don't know. I wasn't there until later.
No, I think you're right. And I think it's addressed, you know, not super explicitly, but it's addressed in the documentary that comedy and music were brother and sister at this time and place, and that they were underground and it was edgy and it was rough in a way that SNL isn't now. SNL now is incredibly polished, but they still provide space for transformative performances and space for people to be a little bit edgier. But at the time, especially early on, it was a sandbox for sure.
Yeah.
And like a play space for a lot of artists and musicians.
And it goes into this idea of how we engage with the show now as well. Back before the internet and being able to watch anything, anytime, anywhere, you had to be there. So I never saw the Fear concert live, but that's my era, right? Like I should have been
you just
something.
Had a date. You just weren't there.
I just weren't there. I was out. I was out doing something else. And now, you know, and I think Lonely Island really were the progenitors of that. They're the ones that broke that open, right? Is creating these like music videos, even though they were having fun and they were lo-fi and all of this kind of stuff. I think it did usher in that change of how we engage the show. And it was because music changed the way, you know, or how we could watch it. And so they started, you know, clipping it up and breaking it up. And that in the 70s and early 80s with all these different music scenes in New York City, which was the cultural capital of the country. You had Los Angeles for film and TV, you know, production, and you had New York for stage and music. And, you know, stuff happened everywhere, you know, here and there. But it really was, New York City was where it was this cauldron, this seething cauldron of culture going on. And then Saturday Night Live was this little one tiny window into that world. And yeah, you could turn on one Saturday and see a punk band. And then the next Saturday you could see a, you know, smooth jazz. And then the next Saturday you could see, you know, Stevie Wonder or what have you. And so it was how we engaged in culture and learned about new things, because we didn't have any other forms to do that. We didn't have any other transmissions. We had, you know, radio, and we had albums and, you know, CDs and tapes and whatever, at whatever era you check in and music. But to get live music, to see a live performance by an artist as a cultural signal booster, Saturday Night Live is unparalleled, I think, in a lot of ways.
Well, and we can remember that, and they talk about this in the doc, that before that, live didn't happen on TV.
Right.
For the most part, at least. I'm sure it did sometimes, but the performance guest appearances would be lip syncing, or they would be, you know, or at the very least singing along with a backing track. You wouldn't have like a band play.
Right.
You know, there's the iconic Sullivan Show performance of the Beatles. Like there, it did exist, but not in the way that Saturday Night Live was just week after week bringing live music with all its imperfections.
Yeah.
And maybe fewer imperfections now.
But we still see a lot of imperfections and a lot of controversial performances through history of people that once they had the mic, they took it kind of hijacked the show.
Man, Kanye West has a way of making everybody feel uncomfortable.
I don't even want to like give space to Kanye West right now. I'm not into it. But yeah, I mean, everyone felt uncomfortable. I remember that. I was watching that live and I was like, what is this guy doing? Like,
and they spend they spend some time on the documentary about that 2018 appearance. And it is, it was disturbing to watch, but it's, again, it's what is this show doing? It is, it's culture alive, right?
Right.
We're wrestling with stuff.
And I think it's inspiring and like really powerful to see artists that are like, you know, I'm going to be an opportunist and I'm going to express myself and, you know, whatever happens, happens. But there were a lot of times that it wasn't intentional. Like we look at Ashley Simpson's lip syncing incident of 2004. Sure. And that's all I remember Ashley Simpson for.
Yeah.
I mean, that's iconic to me. When I think of Ashley Simpson, I think of her doing that little jig dance. When she didn't know what to do with herself when the wrong track played. So some were kind of deal breakers for some artists. And for me, for Kanye, like that SNL performance was a deal. That was where I stopped. I was like, I appreciated his music up until that. But that's when I was like, Kanye's not, I can't get into it.
And then that gets into that whole conversation too, that I think we've been having with some other shows and with some other artists is, do you separate, you know, how to separate the artist from the art? If the art is good, but the artist, you know, if I see a Bill Cosby sketch, I'm probably going to laugh because the man was funny, but God, he was a monster, right? He was an absolute monster behind the scenes. But when he was up on stage, you know, what was the cartoon, the Fat Albert Gang, right? There was, you know, it was a positive show for kids. So yeah, this whole question of how do we extract art from the artist?
That comes up a lot for Mark and I when we're kind of talking through some artists on the pod and who to cover and who not. I mean, Mark, I don't want to speak for you, but I know that you're a big Michael Jackson fan. And I know that we've had real long conversations on and off mic of how much space do we want to give, quote, problematic performers.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, to clarify, I like the music of Michael Jackson.
Sure. Sorry.
And that's very different. Like, and we actually, spoiler, near the end of the season, we've already recorded it. Because we, me in particular, I hemmed and hawed about that artist. I don't know.
Yeah.
Problematic art was just this difficult thing. And finally, we just do an episode where we talk about it. And so we definitely do this a little bit more justice later because we don't have the time to open it all up now because it was like a half hour conversation or whatever. But yeah, it's a tough thing that I'm just going to leave it at that for now.
Well, then we have the Sinead O'Connor protest song in 1992, which they spend some time on the documentary talking about, where she rips up the picture of Pope John Paul. And that's also a hard one to deal with, right? Because of what she, as an individual, dealt with.
Yeah.
But then there's how many millions of people who are in good faith, you know, how Catholicism is meaningful to them, was and is meaningful to them. And again, for a live show, and then we go back to the Elvis Costello Radio Rebellion in 77, which they talk about, where you're on live, they don't know what you're going to do. And not unlike with the Kanye West thing, like, do we stop it? Do we not stop it?
I don't even get that. Like, I missed something.
Like, why do they care that they changed the song?
Right. Like, why was it even a big deal?
Radio was a song that was a rebellious song. It was a song about how radio was managed and controlled in England at the time. And so this was a song that was actually, you know, saying, hey, there's a bunch of people gatekeeping, you know, music and culture and stuff like that. So that song is a anthem. So it's a protest song.
Here's Elvis Costello.
In the dress rehearsal, we did a song that was on my first album, but I thought it sounded a little too slow. It was a medium tempo song and I didn't think it was exciting enough. And I realized this show is live. We can do anything we want.
I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen, there's no reason to do this song here.
Radio, radio. One, two, three.
With the Elvis thing, I was sitting with Dan Aykroyd on home base. You're just watching him. I go, oh, I think we're being hijacked.
I was tuning in the shine of the light, not dial doing anything my radio advised. Whenever one of those late night stations playing songs, bringing tears to my eyes. They say you had better do as you were told. listen to the riddle.
Yeah. I mean, it's so funny how times change.
Right. I feel like, though, with like Sinead O'Connor, how do you not respect that? You could be right. upset about what she did, but she took great personal risk to make a point.
And you can see her. She was shaking on stage. She's actually having an emotional reaction.
It has to have been a terrifying moment for her, right? And so to not feel empathy for that and to not kind of root for her and lament how that kind of killed her career, even if somebody might have been upset, if you're, you know, devout Catholic or something, that feels a little different from, not to bring him up again, but Kanye's rant, right? Because like she spent all of her social capital in that one moment. Like mm-hmm. she just believed like, something and acted.
And she did it all just to reclaim her narrative, right? To reclaim her story and to change the ending a little bit. Instead of being a victim of Catholicism, a victim of child abuse, she was putting herself in a power position. And for me, when I saw her shaking, it wasn't nerves. It was like empowerment and adrenaline of like, I'm doing it, right? Mm. Like I'm taking it all back. I'm taking all the power back from this institution.
Interesting. And that's a different interpretation to.
Right. And like also it was probably really scary. And the fact that she long conned it in some capacity and then did something different. And then the live show was like, all roads led here.
Yeah.
It was brave. It took a lot of bravery. And
they didn't, they could have cut away. I mean, it's simulcast, so, you know, they're recording it at 11 in New York City, but they're rebroadcasting it on the West Coast at 11, so, you know, with the time delay. I remember seeing it, but that may be one of those Mandela moments because it was such a thing. It made so much news. But I have a memory that I watched that, but maybe that's a false one.
False memories are pretty easy to manipulate.
They are. They're easy to generate, right? Because we're always recreating those neural pathways and just switch one over.
You're getting it. You're doing it. You're doing it.
I now know what prepared piano is. So,
oh, nice. Yeah, it's a different show.
That Oscar episode that you did with Alicia, Mark, was great. It was so informative and so interesting. So I really appreciate it. So if you haven't heard that yet, go listen to it.
Everybody. Check it out on the Lorehounds feed. There was one, I appreciate that some artists did something different live. They would take a risk. And I have to say, there's one that didn't quite work for me, but I want to ask Nicole. Sure. I know you are a big fan of the song Man Who Sold the World.
Yes.
Specifically, that comes up. Shout out to our own podcast. What is that? Episode 4, our covers episode.
Sure.
One of Nicole's favorite covers was the Nirvana cover of. But David Bowie performs this and they take like a totally different interpretation of it. There's all these vocal harmonies. And both of you may have caught on by now that I love me some vocal harmonies. I did not like these vocal harmonies. But I have to say, like, I appreciated just the weirdo risk they took in that performance.
I love that. I actually have that in my notes when I was watching this. I was like ferociously typing notes on my laptop. My husband thought I was like, what are you doing, nerd?
this documentary is so dense and
so
it sparks off so many different. Yeah.
So I was thinking about Bowie and that specific performance. I love the Nirvana version of it. I think I like it more than the original. But the way that the band played to the camera in that performance, that strong eye contact. They looked like right down the barrel of the camera during that performance. And a lot of it gave permission to be weird. And I think Bowie did that a lot, but other bands did too, like the Talking Heads, the B-52s, like their performances gave people that lived in middle of nowhere, Nebraska, permission to be New York weird.
Right.
And I think that gave such a gift to so many people that were like thirsty for an outlet. And to see David Bowie on, you know, broadcast TV, just being a weirdo, it probably just empowered a lot of kids and a lot of grownups to like be their most authentic self. But yeah, I didn't love the SNL performance of it, except for them staring right in the camera. The piano player just not even looking at the keys, just looking right at the camera. It was so creepy. I loved it.
Mark, I think we're going to start to wrap up here a little bit, but I wanted to get a couple of thoughts from you in terms of live music production. Obviously, the Studio 8H has a long history, and it's an incredible space that, you know, over 1,400, you know, 1,500 performances have happened. But can you talk a little bit about the complexity of dropping in and doing a live show? You know, if you're just the musical guest, you know, they're bringing you somewhere in midweek, you've got a sound check and then play. And there's this question of, you know, live versus lip syncing or backing tracks. Can you just talk a little bit about live music production in an environment like this?
I mean, I don't know the nuances of that studio.
Sure, sure.
I have not yet played SNL. I have not yet been invited as
love
a host
that growth
or
mindset.
A musical guest. Yeah, but
Lauren Michaels listens to this podcast regularly.
Yeah, for sure.
Right. This is your demo.
Hit me up. nevermusicpod@gmail.com. although Nicole might answer the email and never tell me, she's going to respond.
No,
oh, thanks, we're not interested.
It's so obvious that I don't even know the login information, Mark.
Oh, no. Okay. All right.
Happened on my radar.
So, I'm going to call you out, Nicole, on the podcast. You printed out the outline for this episode.
I did. I have it because I was like, there, I thought I was going to get in trouble if I didn't. You guys are so organized. I'm not.
Okay. So, I think this actually goes back in some ways connects to the commitment that is playing on SNL. Because as somebody who's played in bands and played a lot of different kinds of clubs and stuff, the chaos of different venues is terrifying and frankly terrible. Like until you get to be a really high level performer where you can, meaning in terms of well-known and a hot ticket, where you can really command every single aspect,
You might find yourself yellow M&Ms, only yellow M&Ms in your M&M bowl or whatever the...
That's right. Yes. When your rider can do... I mean, there's lots of reasons to still do that, even if you're not super major. But not everybody's bringing all of their own equipment, right? You're using the house PA. You're using some of the techs for the house. They're like, there's just so much that can just go wrong or be different. And there's something about the SNL... especially when you host, but I think even just when you perform, the grind of being on SNL that probably can help you get comfortable with the space. If you have to go there for 2 days and work with the cast and rehearse and do all this stuff that in a lot of ways would be a negative, right? Because you're worn out, you're barely sleeping, but you're actually getting to experience the space you're in as opposed to a lot of environments where you kind of walk up. You get your short sound check, but then you still never can really hear yourself the way you want to hear yourself. Like, I wonder if, what is it, Studio 8H? Mm-hmm. I wonder if the Studio 8H becomes sort of just home at a certain point if you're playing SNL because you have to spend so much time there. And I could be wrong, but it seemed like even the musical guests that weren't hosting weren't just showing up to play, except for these kind of funny emergency scenarios they were talking about, yeah, that you would be there the day before at least rehearsing and just kind of being a part of the prep that I feel like offsets some of the terror and because live sound is just so tough and it's so unpredictable and so much could go wrong, even if you're a 3-piece rock band or whatever, that maybe it makes it a little more okay to be a part of this production.
Mm-hmm.
Can I put you on the spot, Mark, and ask, a lot of times in comedy when like people break in the scene or things go wrong and actors start laughing, those are like very memorable scenes that become very endearing to the audience. As someone that performs live in a band and you're a musician, right? Can you tell us a time that things went tragically wrong for you and they like weren't okay? Do you have like a horror story you could share to finish us off today?
I don't know if David has that other stuff he wants to talk about.
Oh,
no,
sorry.
No, I'm curious. You know what? I'm curious. I was just thinking about when those moments did happen on Saturday Night Live and how magical they were. There was one with Don Rickles, obviously not a musical guest, but I that is so burned into my mind because they were cracking. I think it was him and Joe Piscopo, and they were just cracking each other up and they were breaking character and they're barely holding it together. I don't have as many musical, I'm not as musically oriented. And so, yeah, I'm curious to know Mark's, maybe, you know, we can close on a memorable performance. Like, what's a musical act that you're really interested in? But I am interested, Mark, to hear.
All right. So, I mean, I learned as an adult, eventually, it's okay to start over. Because you mentioned that I used to sing a cappella or whatever. I can remember being on stage. I don't remember if it was competitions with my college a cappella group or just big venues with like 1,000 people watching us. And somebody would blow the pitch pipe and we would start singing and somebody heard it wrong and we were just off. And nobody had the sort of maturity to say, no, start over. Whereas now I would just stop and go, let's start over. And instead of the whole song just being terrible, but my most things gone wrong memory of all time is me probably at the age of 10 or 11. And I forgot my music at the piano recital. Like I did not bring it. I left it at home and I went up on stage cause I had it memorized and I just couldn't do it. I played the first chord. And I just couldn't, and I wasn't like, this wasn't high level piano playing. I was a 10-year-old or 11-year-old, and I just couldn't do it. And I look back at that, like I started to play it, and even though I knew every single chord of whatever dumb little 90-second thing I was playing, I couldn't bring myself, I mean, maybe this is why I kind of obsessively prep now, but I think back to that as I should have done it. Like I should have just been just messed up. I know the music, trust yourself to know the music. And so I think back to that moment, and I share this with my students sometimes because like stage fright is a real thing. And I sort of was overcome by it. And I just picked up and everybody gasped and I picked myself up off the bench and sat back down in the row and the next student came up to play. And Bloody. I should have just done it and believed in myself because probably 4 seconds in, I would have remembered most of it, right? And nobody would have noticed if I made some mistakes. I knew most of it, right?
There's an expectation, right? That like, oh, there's a little mess up there. And we're looking to see somebody recompose themselves and pick up where
You just fake it. So there's probably so many mistakes in iconic SNL performances that you don't notice because the artist doesn't wince or something. The drummer misses a beat, but they just keep going. You just keep going.
Which is so sad about the Ashley Simpson thing, because if they had just been able to stop that track playing, and I don't know why that couldn't get stopped. They could have just gone, oh, okay, well, let's play live now. Boom, go. And we would have been all amazed.
Just stop and own it and joke about it and start it again and own the narrative, right?
Because
what was it? Her voice was dead or something. She's like, all right, y'all,
she was trying to protect. Yeah.
And then she could sing it and her cold would be bad and she could laugh about it. And granted, that was late 90s. We were very much still stuck on authenticity being the only important thing. Don't sell out. The idea that somebody would be lip syncing was anathema, even though
2004, probably, I think.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I still felt like we were in that vibe where people were still fighting things like that. She couldn't just own it, really. It's too bad.
So, Nicole, do you have any particular, what's your one musical remembrance from Saturday Night Live? Something that we've talked about already or something we haven't yet?
Well, you know, I have something that is more recent. It wasn't in the documentary, even though we're not in the same space. I know Mark's going to roll his eyes, but this past Christmas, Hozier did a really great performance on Saturday Night Live sang like Angels of New York or something. I don't even know the name of the song. I was just mesmerized by him. But I love when we take a song and like strip it down to acoustics and strip it down to just the singer with the guitar on stage. And you get a really authentic, like live version of something.
Right.
Those have always been the most memorable performances for me when it is truly live and really just simple and doesn't have a lot of production. To me, the stuff on SNL that gets overly like,
I am so stage-y. With you. That was one of my notes too, that I don't like the overproduced musical stuff. I just want to see the artists on stage, the kind of tiny stuff that they're doing with tiny desk concerts, right?
Right.
Like, they're like little mini Super Bowl performances almost sometimes.
Kanye started it all and ruined it. And that's what they said in the documentary. Sorry. They said that once Kanye came and said, I'm not going to perform against the brick wall. I want a special setup. That's when everyone else kind of had to, he popped the bubble on it. And that's sad to me. I love the stripped down version. I don't know. How about you guys? What do you think?
I think for me, from the comedy set standpoint, again, it's Eddie Murphy who with his parodies. But I have to say, and we already talked about it, the single most iconic memory, musical memory for me is Sinead O'Connor tearing the picture of Pope. That there's, I can't, nothing, that is such an eclipsing moment that if you were to ask me about music, if you were to say, David, music, Saturday Night Live, go, I'd be like, oh, Sinead O'Connor. Like that would be the thing that's top of my head, regardless of whether I saw it live or not.
Yeah. See, I definitely didn't see much live, but that I didn't get that until I was an adult. That happened. I was too young to have any context of what that meant. Like, why is this person mad at the, I do remember hearing about that, but I didn't have any sort of context for why it was important or respect for its importance. So for me, I would go, as much as I've said, you know, more, Lonely Island, the funniest, it's more cowbell for sure.
Yeah.
But then it's the Rage Against the Machine performance. There's just something about that. That just encapsulates this moment that you can't control anything. Mm. And you can try, but you can't. And that's beautiful. And that's emblematic of that band, of course. That's emblematic of the subversion of that show, potentially, that they try to stop, but sometimes still gets through. Again, didn't see that live, but heard about it. And it's just such a great sort of snapshot of that era for me.
Cool. Well, I think we would all agree that if you're listening to this podcast, you should go and watch this documentary. But by hook or by crook, got to see this thing.
Got to at least the first 6 minutes.
Yeah.
If you have time for nothing else.
Absolutely. And as we're recording this, this is the weekend when they're going to have the big celebration. So there is a big musical concert that's going to be happening. And then there's going to be the big show itself. And then there's a second documentary, like a four-part behind the scenes, taking apart the show itself. And that's on my watch list. My wife and I are going to watch it, but we haven't got it started yet.
Awesome.
I also think this weekend they're playing on Saturday night is the first episode of Saturday Night Live. They'll play it in primetime.
Oh, really?
Whoa.
Yeah, I think so as
cool.
well. So check it out. Lots of great content.
Yeah, great. Well,
speaking of great content.
Yeah. Did you have content?
Should we pitch each other's content? Is what
yes, we should. We should definitely pitch each other's content. What is going on with Nevermind the Music?
So at the point that we're recording, we've got our Dua Lipa episode talking about levitating. But what's blown up on the Discord, Nicole? The people, they love personality tests.
The people love it. They're clamoring for personality tests. They're like, send me links. What's my Myers-Briggs type? What's my Big Five assessment? I don't know. Maybe it's pseudoscience. Maybe there's truth to it.
It's certainly fascinating.
We're like sharing screenshots, which feels like a HIPAA violation, but we're doing it. So come and check us out on Discord.
The Dua Lipa episode was excellent episode, by the way.
It's been my favorite so far. I think it's really iconic for like what we're trying to do. And it was one of the earlier episodes we recorded, too.
Nice. This is the closing. Yeah, this is the waltz. Yeah.
Yeah. How many more episodes in the bag for Nevermind the Music? You guys got a bunch more in the queue.
We got a lot. We got the whole we're going through this summer, David.
Okay.
We are planning the next season though now. So we've already got songs in mind. We've got sidetrack ideas.
Spreadsheets are happening.
Every time I hear a song that something catches me about it, I've been starting to write it down, and I know you have very small window of intersection between a song and the psychology stuff. I know I'm keeping lists, and I don't know if other people are, but I'm always restraining myself of going, cover this song, cover that song.
What's going on with Lorehounds right now, Dave?
Severance. We're doing Severance with joint production with Properly Howard with Steve and Anthony. and we're doing weekly coverage of that on the special Severance feed. Alicia has been hard at work. She just rolled off of Wool Shift Dust, and now she's right in the middle of her Oscar coverage, and she's doing a great tour of all of the different things that are going on with all of the Oscars movies. She and I are going to record our bookend recap in a couple of weeks. But in the meantime, she's covering music. She's covering the animation. She's covering the Best Picture nominations. And she's got a whole talk about spreadsheets. Got a lot going on there. And then to roll off of that and roll on to Wheel of Time, which I know the big show. So, you know, no rest for the wicked, wow, as they say.
Wow.
And then we've got White Lotus starting, and John and I will do some light coverage of that. But because The Last of Us is going to start up, John's going to be taking the lead on that, and that's going to be overlapping, and then that's going to overlap with Andor, which I'll be taking the production lead on. We are busy right on through the spring.
Got so much TV this year. Oh my gosh.
I know,
and
right?
Good shows.
But yeah, it's going to be a very busy year. A good year for podcasting.
Love it. This was fun,
ping
guys.
Ping us whenever you need us. This has
absolutely
been really fun.
Been fun. It's been great to have you guys both on the Severance. Mark, you got to do some more, you got to dig up some nuggets out of the Severance to talk about for music and sound.
Yeah, we'll
design.
Get there. It's a mind-blowing season.
All right, guys, thanks very much. And we will be talking to you soon.
Sounds good. Thank you.
For sure.
Excellent. If we release 3 episodes per week, the Lorehounds will never be able to cover every episode. The Imperial forces will crush the rebellion before it begins.
Stand by. We're picking up something on our scanners.
Echo Squadron, reporting in.
Delta Squadron, on your left.
Django Squadron, on your 6.
With Imperial forces coming in fast, we're calling all rebels to join the fight this season. Starting after the April 22nd premiere, you'll hear 3 full breakdowns for each week's episodes of Andor Season 2. Each podcast will be led by one of our squadron leaders, Alicia, David, and John. We'll be bringing in new and familiar voices to fill out the roster. Search for the Lorehounds on any podcast platform to join us in a galaxy far, far away. And don't forget to check out our season pass for even more content like our Holocron bonus pods. It's good news for anyone, except Darth Vader.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.